Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we are going through the content to kind of help refute or basically deal with the misrepresentation of how our government evolved. There is way too many people that think that the Articles of Confederation are the legitimate, you know, founding documents and governing documents and so forth, that the Constitution is illegitimate. That is absolutely wrong. And as a matter of fact, the problem is not the Constitution. The problem is that all of the assumed powers, everything that they have done as they've grown themselves outside of the framework of the Constitution has been unconstitutional the entire way. Now, we have gone through this, and we go through this every year. We show how the creation of the bank was unconstitutional. People like to point out, well, Madison did the same thing. Well, he did the same thing, but he limited the bank to only funding the war, not as a speculative investment opportunity so that people can start making interest. And so I don't think Madison at that time, when America was being attacked, had much time to think about what to do and never really created a strategy. And unfortunately, they were stuck with the bank that they funded the war with. Couldn't get rid of that until they paid the debt back. So, and that was the whole point. The charter of the bank was going to die once it was paid off. And that's exactly what happened. And the guy that took credit for paying the debt off wasn't Madison. It was this, you know, happy-come-lately Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was just in office at the time Madison's plan finally came to fruition. Monroe even talks about this. When we get into the Monroe Doctrine, we will prove that between the Madison and Monroe presidencies, they had an aggressive plan to help pay off the debt. So much so, Monroe was basically saying that our projections are well ahead of schedule. And it gave him the ability to take some money and actually take the freemen out of America, the black freemen out of America, and put them into Africa. Now, I would love to have the time to go find those documents and what he did or how that was done. I don't know if there was a lot of private investment in that or what he did, but I do know one thing. It was something that they didn't have the constitutional authority to do, but it was the best thing to happen, especially if you consider the liberty of, you know, if all people are supposed to have liberty and every person is supposed to enjoy, you know, their own self-destiny and so forth. The concept of allowing people to just stay here stuck in a bad situation. As Thomas Sowell pointed out, slavery didn't create racism. Slavery in America, racism was a byproduct of the way slavery in America was implemented. And remember, who implemented slavery in America in that fashion? That was the Crown of Britain. It was well before King George even came along. The galvanizing of all blacks being slaves and only blacks being slaves in America happened in the 1600s. We weren't even an inkling or some gleam in anybody's eye that we were going to become a country. And if you really, as we go through this, you'll actually see that the framers really didn't want to break away from Britain. And I believe that somebody else felt it was imperative that they do so that the world would have a shot at actually having liberty, because it had been proven, and it proves, it stands today, folks, that liberty has only been enjoyed in America. And it is setting. Liberty is setting in America. So as we kind of go through these real quick obligatories, I will just do that. Learn, pray, act. I need to remind you, as we appeal to heaven, you need to continually learn. And as you learn and understand more, we become far more, I think, more direct and more cognitive of what we really need and how we, you know, need to be acting and so forth. So anyway, education, getting smart, and understanding, becoming literate. The more literate we become, the more powerful we become. And so as we become powerful, then we can be a more powerful tool in his hands in that appeal to heaven. The point of compliance to the Constitution should be a primary focus for the DOJ. Actually, your campaign should also be echoing that call that we all need to be holding each other. If they're in public office, all public servants need to be holding each other accountable to their oath. When somebody votes on, we need to be on a race to the top. Instead of saying, well, how quickly can we compromise the finances? How quickly can we compromise our government and our stability and everything else? Instead, hey, how quickly can we take back this government by looking, hey, you voted for something. You put a bill out that was a violation of the Constitution. Shame on you, and you need to be removed from office because you actually purported a bill that would violate the Constitution. You're gone. You're out of here. Holding people accountable. That is the process. It's very, very simple. Everybody right now is looking over their shoulder whenever they hear me talk. And what I mean by that is public servants are scared because if they start having to hold other people accountable, even though they're not really the bad guy, they know that the heat will come on them too. And everybody needs to be scrutinized. As long as we give them this blind trust, they're going to continually sell us downriver and constantly screw us over. We've got to do something about it. Accountability and constitutional compliance is the only way. Don't forget, I've got a presidential campaign. If you want to get engaged, let me know and let me know what you're doing so that we can start sharing your Electoral College candidacy. Because my presidential candidacy is dependent upon a nationwide Electoral College candidacy. What that means, folks, is that's right. You actually, we need to have people running as candidates, just like your representative in Congress. We need to have people running as the elector for that congressional district. We need to have two at large Electoral College candidates. And by doing this, if we actually start setting the stage, there's no doubt in my mind, people are going to start waking up and going, what? We're not supposed to be voting on the people for president? We're supposed to choose our electors? What is this? What cockamamie thing is this? And then we can start explaining the Republican form of government and how it's supposed to be working. And hopefully everybody can start appreciating and actually demanding compliance to the Constitution instead of playing these games that, we're gonna go ahead and allow these political compromises to sell us downriver. Compliance to the Constitution, that would never happen. When you look at what is legally allowable for political compromise, it is only within the enumerated objects. They can't go along and say, well, we think we need to give you some health care. We need to regulate the labor and establish a minimum wage. That's not open for political compromise. It's not enumerated. And yet they've compromised and it's inflicted upon us. It's an assumption of power in a compromise. They don't have the power to do it. It's that simple. So what do we do? We have to hold them accountable. We have to challenge everything that they've done, line by line. We have to oppose every infraction. If you're starting to appreciate the fact that Martin Luther wrote a comprehensive list of 95 theses, 95 direct violations of the scriptures of the church, and so forth, then you can start understanding why we have to take a stand on all things. And that wasn't really comprehensive. That was as comprehensive as Martin Luther could make it and get it out. The table of tyranny is huge, folks. It is prodigious. Most people do not understand the magnitude of tyranny we're living under. And I am here to tell you that it just shocks me. It shocks me that we don't have any county commissioners, county supervisors, any county legislators that are demanding an emergency session and emergency action and the same thing at the state legislative level. We are at the brink, and the people, our representatives, are doing nothing because our courts have seized control and said, don't worry, we got this. And they don't. They have no authority over these things. And they've assumed jurisdiction and authority over everything, just like the rest of government. So anyway, let's dive into, because what we want to cover, and there's a lot of little things I could cover. I'll try to catch up on some personal stuff and so forth, why we've been having problems broadcasting and so forth, maybe down the road. But I need to get through these treaties, because once I get through those, then there's other stuff that needs to be covered. So with that, because we're hitting the ratification dates right now, and so as we start coming back, and probably sometime this week, we'll actually start reading the ratification dates. And so hopefully you're going to start really enjoying the learning about the Constitution from the framers, as these men pounded out and literally defined it. I mean, they went to the nth degree in understanding why the Constitution was done the way they did it. Anyway, nobody better can explain that to you. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive in, because we've already covered the Louisiana Purchase, and we've also covered the Treaty of Ghent. We've already done those. So what we're now going to cover is the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and that's an 1848 treaty with Mexico. Now, I'm trying to garner why, because these secessionists, state nationals, sovereign citizens, whatever you want to call them, and all these others, general assemblies, they all use the same kind of justification. Oh, they do, because they did this and they did that, they did this, this means that this is constitutional. Folks, when it comes to a treaty, the only thing that they can do within that treaty are within the enumerated objects. So if a treaty is ratified and enacted, it can be equally an assumption of unconstitutional power not granted. Just like when they create the Department of Transportation. They go off and create the Department of Transportation. Then what that means is that they have assumed powers that have not been granted. So, as we go through these treaties, if they're using and they're agreeing to things that they do not have enumerated, anything that has been delegated to them, then they are actually making an illegitimate treaty. So the treaty with the UN, illegitimate. Go read petition 2 on the petition page. That's where you'll actually, I think your mind will open up to go, oh, now I get that. Okay. Anyway, so what we're going to do is we're going to kind of cover the introduction, and then we're going to go into the 23 articles of this petition, or actually this treaty. This treaty was signed on February 2nd, 1848. And actually, just to help you understand this, this is what galvanized the continental United States. This was after the war had ended between the United States and Mexico. By its terms, Mexico seceded 55% of its territory, including the present-day states California, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, most of Arizona and Colorado, and parts of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming. Mexico also relinquished all claims to Texas and reorganized the Rio Grande as the southern boundary with the United States. The Treaty of the Guadalupe Hidalgo, which brought an official end to the American War in 1846-48, was signed again on February 2nd, 1848. And it was done at the city of Guadalupe Hidalgo, a city to which the Mexican government had fled with the advance of U.S. forces. So in other words, as they stopped there, we said, okay, we're not going to chase you anymore. We will now create a treaty so that we will possess the rest of this property. With the defeat of its army and the fall of the capital, Mexico City, in September 1847, the Mexican government surrendered to the United States and entered into negotiations to end the war. The peace talks were negotiated by Nicholas Trist, chief clerk of the State Department, who had accompanied General Winfield Scott as a diplomat and President Polk's representative. Trist and General Scott, after two previous unsuccessful attempts to negotiate a treaty with President Santa Anna, determined that the only way to deal with Mexico was as a conquered enemy. Nicholas Trist negotiated with a special commission representing the collapsed government led by Don Bernardo Couto and Don Miguel Estrien, or let me see here, Atristain, and Don Luis Gonzalez or Gonzaga, actually Gonzaga, I'm going to get the last name wrong, Cuevas. Anyway, President Polk had called Trist in, there were some names there instead of saying them, trying to pronounce the names. Anyway, President Polk had recalled Trist in October 1847 under the belief that negotiations would be carried out with a Mexican delegation in Washington. In the 6 weeks it took to deliver Polk's message, Trist received the Mexican government had named its special commission to negotiate. Trist determined that Washington did not understand the situation in Mexico and negotiated the peace treaty in defiance to the president. Did he have the authority and power to do so? Well, at that point in time, see, we've talked about real governing. We've talked about real-time governing. Real-time governing is when you actually have the ability to instantly say, do this now, do this now, do that now. In other words, if you don't have real-time viewing and real-time communications, you don't have real-time governing. And so what they had was a, what did it take, 6 weeks? In the 6 weeks it took to deliver Polk's message, it took 6 weeks to get the message to him. And so he had already gone down this path of doing all these other things. So when everything came out, let's look at this. In December 4th, 1847, letter to his wife, Trist wrote, knowing it would be the very last chance and impressed with the dreadful consequences to our country, which cannot fail to attend the loss of that chance, I decided at noon to attempt to make a treaty and decision it altogether on my own. Trist sent a copy to Washington, and President Polk forwarded the treaty to the Senate for their advice and consent. When the Senate reluctantly ratified the treaty by a vote 34-14 on March 10, 1848, it removed Article 10 guaranteeing the protection of Mexican land grants. Following the ratification, the United States withdrew its troops from the Mexican capital. With the annexation, so in other words, Trist did the right thing. They couldn't wait and allow America to start actually. Remember the Alamo? Remember these things that were happening? And how Mexico was at this point where they thought that they could just, you know, beat us at war and on their own conquest basically assume all of this territory that they were not occupying to a point where they were holding it. In other words, there may have been the Catholic Church setting up churches along California. There may have been these small little communities, but for the vast amount of land. So when you understand the American methodology of expanse and the admission of states into the Union, the federal government then takes the authority over the territories by putting cavalry and those types of things to help transition and getting rid of the enemy or fighting off the enemy. Well, while we were doing this, Mexico basically started taking action in trying to presume and conquest up through America. And if they were going to get a toehold into the West Coast and going all the way, they probably would have went all the way up to Canada. Why not? All the resources and everything else would have been there. If you understand, you know, why Santa Anna wanted to actually expand his power, and it's about obtaining wealth. The United States government was not a government that was allowed to obtain wealth, which is why it was so successful, because the wealth was retained by the local states and by the local people. So property rights and the development of these lands was done by the people. To be clear here, as we look at how everything was being done in government throughout the history of mankind, it was always consolidating for those who governed. They were the ones in the pit of opulence. Now we actually see a nation where the governing is not allowed to have the pit of opulence. The people who are being governed are the ones that actually are carrying the work of entrepreneurial efforts and developing wealth and so forth. This is why America became so great. And it was literally a plan of the British Empire, because that paradigm, it has been a persisting paradigm. Even today, I even listened to a man in Parliament actually go on to a rant over the woke generation in England talking about climate change. And boy, if the climate change people had their way, they would just cripple Britain, because, you know, they would have that level of control. And then he said, but what would the consequence be? Because we don't even have an impact of 2% of the climate. So if we can't even make that kind of impact, then what kind of victory is it if they just destroy us because they want us to do this? So he goes through these merits of, you know, climate control and everything else. And the only way we're going to actually start getting on top of, let's just say, the environment and becoming better stewards of this earth is through innovation, technology, and hard work, not by attacking productivity. As a matter of fact, the majority of all of the CO2 and supposedly all these evil emissions that they want to get rid of, this guy's pointing out that the poor nations, Central Africa, Central America, South America, China, and Asia, the poor nations are the number one polluters. I mean, North America, or I should say United States and Canada, as well as Australia and other, you know, the civilized nations are the ones that are actually going overboard in trying to reduce, and the mass pollution is getting worse and worse. So how is it that the poor is going to give up what they need to do to be productive? We might as well just go kill them, because that's exactly what would happen. Taking away their ability to have energy, whatever resource that they can afford. So it's not about global communism. It's about actually working, and actually, if you really look at the design and the divine plan of the Constitution of states coming into the Union, it only makes sense. It only makes sense if you come into a land of liberty, you can do these things. I see what we're doing with the UN and these treaties and everything else. It is just, it's a facade. They can't fix the problem because there's no will to fix the problem by the people. The people are being constrained, and the governors or those who govern, just as we've talked about before, those who govern are the tyrants, because they're allowed to live their life in the pit of opulence. Anyway, we're going to go into a break. When we come back, I'll get right back into this treaty. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we're going to get into this. As a matter of fact, it just came to my attention that one of the things that I'm not covering, because I just was looking while I was a break here, I was looking at what we were covering, and we're not covering the 1853 Gaddesden purchase. Now, we'll get into that right now because it was mentioned in this introduction that we have here for you on the treaty. With the annexation of more than 525,000 square miles of land, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo extended the boundaries of the United States to the Pacific Ocean from what we know as California all the way up to, well, I think by this point in time, we were purchasing the British Columbia, or up to British Columbia, to Washington State. So, actually, yeah, by this point in time, we had established the line that goes all the way up to Washington. So what we're seeing is the contiguous 48 states have almost completely been galvanized. It is American territory all the way out. The only thing that didn't have was the small thing that the Gaddesden Purchase in 1853 finalized. So in other words, here in 1848, the United States now had all of this massive land. Ah, but whose land was it? Was it the federal government's or was it the Union's? Everything is the Union's. The federal government is the agent that serves the Union in meeting its obligations, its roles, responsibilities within that Constitution. Therefore, all the territory needed to be projected into becoming states to be admitted into the Union as co-parties to the compact, equally footed co-parties. This is why you need to read Why Counties Matter Most, because I lay it out that when the federal government started actually playing these shenanigans of controlling what kind of land that the state, you know, they could take from the state and actually tell the state what they could do with their land or what they can't do, they had no authority. The Constitution only allowed them to make the needful rules and regulations while it was a territory. Once it becomes a state, folks, wake up. Every single one of your states is a solid, sovereign state. Anything that the federal government has placed upon the state, now see, this is something Madison didn't even fathom. In the resolutions of 1798 and his report and so forth, he didn't really get into or even talk about how each state was being brought in, because it didn't start happening until Indiana, after he was stepping down from his presidency. As he kind of watched that, what was going on, that there were so many different things that were happening Madison, once again in 1821, we've already read this for you this year. Go back and listen to our reading of the Madison to John G. Jackson letter, where Madison really emphasizes the fact that you need to read the ratification debates to understand the Constitution so that you can place context to what the federal government really should be doing instead of allowing them to do what they're doing. So, folks, the point is that any federal interest, any federal dictations, regulations, or anything that are happening within your state is not constitutional. So as they were amassing all of this land, as they had amassed all of this land, I should say, guess what they ended up doing in 1849? They created the Department of Home, also known in the U.S. Senate as the Department of Everything Else. In other words, as the federal government was trying to figure out how they were going to rule us, because now they had ascended to a point of such noble governing that they, you know, had this grand idea that they would just be able to do whatever they thought was best. And they were such good men. So as we kind of watch, as everything lays out, we can actually see how the United States was being set up so that the states would become subservient to the federal government. In other words, the perversion and everything else was well underway as soon as Madison was stepping out of office. But the plan was laid out in the judiciary in 1800 when Marshall brought the Federalist Papers in. And when Marshall started using and building the case that the Federalist Papers are the primary guide, and every patriot that wants to stand up and cheer for the Federalist Papers clearly has no idea that the Federalist Papers were written and designed, the machinations of Hamilton were to utilize the court to aggrandize the federal government. And that's exactly what happened. In 1800, Marshall aggrandized the jurisdiction to be able to start assuming, using judicial review, to assume jurisdiction over things they had no jurisdiction over. Go read that ruling, and you'll find that he kind of quips real quick that, hey, you know, we may not have jurisdiction, but while we're looking at this, this is what we're going to say and do. Anyway, let me finish up this introduction. The United States government paid Mexico $15 million in consideration of the extension acquired by the boundaries of the United States and agreed to pay American citizens' debts owed to them by the Mexican government. Other provisions included the protection of property and civil rights of Mexican nationals living within the new boundaries of the United States, the promise of the United States to police its boundaries, and compulsory arbitrary of future disputes between the two countries. So, with that, they, you know, moved in, and now we're going to dive into this treaty. But bottom line, as you look at this, again, this treaty was done by a military man because he was out so far away from the headquarters that the president could not engage him. And because they came to a truce and we had the upper hand, the general thought it incumbent to treat them as a defeated enemy that they were and actually lay out what our demands were. And I think he did a great job. Unfortunately, the Constitution didn't allow that really to happen. But because he did it, and because he did have the military authority at that point in time to determine whether to offer peace or what, there's no way he could be challenged. So, as they received it, this is kind of like the treaty for the Louisiana Purchase, where, you know, President Jefferson said, "Yeah, let's go get Louisiana and New Orleans. We definitely want that," and they took the offer from France of taking all that extra property of the whole Delta, the Louisiana, or I should say the Mississippi Delta. And so they said, okay, well, we'll take that. And as it came back, I mean, everybody was, you know, scrambling around. Does the United States have the authority to acquire land? Yes, they do. Through treaties and so forth, they can acquire land. But the United States cannot possess that land as its own state and make their own states. What they have to do is they have to add states into the Union, not United States territories. And the fact that the United States still has territories to this day, such as Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and so forth, is repugnant to the Constitution. So, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, February 2nd, 1848, ratification advised by Senate, advised by Senate with amendments March 10th, 1848, ratified by President March 16th, 1848, ratifications exchanged at Cutero, May 30th, 1848, proclaimed July 4th, 1848. So, in other words, it was kind of, I don't even know if it was necessarily a bitter pill. I don't know if Polk was that kind of president. I don't believe he was. As I understand it, he was, you know, he was very ambitious in trying to galvanize from sea to shining sea type of thing and help support this concept of manifest destiny. But anyway, in the name of Almighty God, not in the name of the Great One of the United States, in the name of Almighty God, the United States of America and the United Mexican States, animated by a sincere desire to put an end to the calamities of the war which unhappily exists between the two republics, and to establish upon a solid basis relations of peace and friendship which shall confer reciprocal benefits upon the citizens of both, and assured the concord, harmony, and mutual confidence wherein the two people should live as good neighbors, have for the purpose appointed their respective plenipotentiaries. This is to say, the President of the United States has appointed Nicholas P. Trist a citizen of the United States, and the President of the Mexican Republic has appointed Don Luis Gonzalez Suarez and Don Bernardo Cueto and Don Miguel Atrestain, citizens of the Republic, who, after a reciprocal communication of their respective full powers, have, under the protection of Almighty God, the author of peace, arranged, agreed upon, and signed the following treaty of peace, friendship, limits, and settlement between the United States of America and the Mexican people. Now, let's keep in mind, let's go back up to what was the amendment that was removed out of this, because I just want to, removed Article 10. And Article 10 is stricken out. So, in other words, we're not going to see what the real language was that they decided, hey, we're not going to abide by that. So, Article 1 of this treaty is this. Immediately upon the signature of this treaty, a convention shall be entered into between a commissioner or commissioners appointed by the General-in-Chief of the Forces of the United States and such as may be appointed by the Mexican government, to end that provisional suspension of hostilities shall take place, and that in the places occupied by the said forces, constitutional order may be reestablished as regards to the political, administrative, and judicial branches, so as this shall be permitted by the circumstances of military occupation. So the one thing I have a problem with is he talks about the regard, it says, to be reestablished as regards to the political, administrative, and judicial branches. Well, why is the judicial branches not, why isn't the Republican branches and the executive branches equally important? They only talk about political, administrative, and judicial. And I think at this point in time, the paradigm of the judiciary was growing. way out of proportion, especially in a Republican form of government. Article 3. So immediately after the ratification of the present treaty by the government of the United States, orders shall be transmitted to the commanders of their land and naval forces requiring the latter, provided this treaty shall have been ratified by the government of Mexican Republic and the ratifications exchanged, immediately to desist from blockading any Mexican ports and requiring the former, under the same conditions, to commence at the earliest moment practicable, withdrawing all troops of the United States then in the interior of the Mexican Republic to points that shall be selected by common agreement at a distance from the seaports not exceedingly 30 leagues, and such evacuation of the interior of the Republic shall be completed with the least possible delay, the Mexican government hereby binding itself to afford every facility in its power to render the same convenient to the troops of their march in and their new positions, and for promoting a good understanding between them and the inhabitants. In like manner, orders shall be dispatched to the persons in charge of the custom houses at all ports occupied by the forces of the United States, requiring them, under the same condition, immediately to deliver possessions of the same to the persons authorized by the Mexican government to receive it, together with all bonds and evidence of debt and duties on importations and on exportations not yet fallen due. Moreover, a faithful and exact account shall be made out showing the entire amount of all duties on imports and on exports collected at such custom houses or elsewhere in Mexico by authority of the United States from and after the day of the ratification of this treaty by the government of Mexican Republic, and also an account of the cost of collection and such entire amount, deducting only the cost of collection, shall be delivered to the Mexican government at the City of Mexico within 3 months after the exchange of ratifications. The evacuation of the capital of the Mexican Republic by the troops of the United States in virtue of the above stipulation shall be completed in 1 month after the orders there stipulated, for shall have been received by the commander of said troops, or sooner if possible. Article 4. Immediately after the exchange of ratifications of the present treaty, all castles, forts, territories, places, and possessions which have been taken or occupied by the force of the United States during the present war without the limits of the Mexican Republic is as about to be established by the following article shall be definitely restored to the said Republic together with all the artillery, arms, apparatus of the war, munitions, and other public property which were in the said castles and forts when captured and which shall remain there at the time when this treaty shall be duly ratified by the government of the Mexican Republic. To this end, immediately upon the signature of this treaty, orders shall be dispatched to the American officers commanding such castles and forts, securing against the removal or destruction of such artillery, arms, apparatus of war, munitions, and other public property. The City of Mexico, within the inner line of the entrenchments surrounding the said city, is comprehended in the above stipulation as regards to the restoration of artillery, apparatus of war, and etc. Now, the thing I'm thinking about is, as you really look at this, the United States went all the way down to Mexico City. They took control of most of their ports along that way. They took control of so much of Mexico that at this point in time, if we were anything like the Portuguese and the Spaniards who conquested and conquered all of South America, Mexico, and so forth, that would have been ours. Do you understand what I just said? All of this land going down into Mexico, that land would have been ours. And we could have just said, you know what, we've come far enough. If you want, we can continue to go all the way down to Honduras and Central America. Is that what you want? You want us to conquer you completely? They could have done that. And so Trist, no doubt, had a powerful position in basically negotiating this treaty. And the fact that he basically acquiesced all of that treaty back. Folks, go look at where Mexico City is. And look at all of the land between Mexico City and the United States. The way I can see this is if you go all the way down to the point of Texas, the farthest southern point that, you know, reaches, what's that, Brownsville, whatever, down in the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of America, whatever. If from that point, I think we were even further south possibly than that, but all the way down and across Mexico to Mexico City. So I'm hoping you could see, you know, what we took and what we maintained. Because the intent was, if you really look at the plan, we had this projected plan that was a part of Britain before we became the United States, before the Revolution. There was this plan that these colonies would basically extend their way all the way over to the Pacific. And while we were there, it was Mexico that actually started expanding and trying to go up along the West Coast, knowing that we weren't dominating over there at that point in time. That was a part of the Spaniard-Mexican, you know, expansion, the conquest for themselves. And so as they started attacking, saying, we're on a conquest, we're taking land, we kind of responded in kind and said, nah, we're not going to let you take that land. Because we kind of had our dibs on that while you guys were just out there, you know, being slaughtered and raped by the Portuguese and the Spaniards. So we're going to hold the line. And even though we never took, you know, you too seriously in attacking us, and you put so much effort in destroying the Alamo that you sent us a message to say, yeah, we can't trust you anymore. And now we're going to, you know, get aggressive and secure our land. And what we're going to do is not only secure our land, we're going to prove to you our superiority in our fighting and so forth, and come all the way down to your door and knock and say, are you ready to surrender now? And that's really what happened. Because, you know, there's the old saying, you don't want to, you know, you just don't go kick a dog while it's lying down. You know, you're just asking for trouble. And so in this particular case, we can see the prominence of the American military even at that point in time. And even though we had the victory and the land secured, we basically just held to what we had a stake in. All the way out to California and all the way up to Washington State, the contiguous 48 states. Now, again, that little part of that exchange that's going to come just, 5 years later that we actually pay for. Again, $15 million. And let's find out when we go into that treaty, how much did we pay for that land? Anyway. The final evacuation of the territory of the Mexican Republic by the force of the United States, this is still Article 4, by the force of the United States shall be completed in 3 months from the said exchange of ratifications or sooner, if possible. The Mexican government hereby engaging, as in the foregoing article, to use all means in its power for facilitating such evacuation and rendering it convenient to the troops, and for promoting a good understanding between them and the inhabitants. If, however, the ratification of this treaty by both parties should not take place in time to allow embarkation of the troops of the United States to be completed before the commencement of the sickly season at the Mexican ports on the Gulf of Mexico, in such case, a friendly agreement shall be entered into between the general-in-chief of the said troops and the Mexican government, whereby healthy and otherwise suitable places at a distance from the ports not exceeding 30 leagues shall be designated for the residence of such troops as may not be yet have embarked until the return of the healthy season. You getting this, folks? And the space of time here referred to as comprehending the sickly season, such as understood to extend from the first day of May to the first day of November. Now, sickly season, that's kind of like the typhoon, or what is that, yellow fever, typhoid, and some of the diseases that Philadelphia was struck with during, you know, the Continental Congress and those types of things. And as a matter of fact, I remember, reading in a few of the history books how, not when I say history books, biographies and so forth, where they had to evacuate Philadelphia because typhoid and the fever was just really, really bad. People were dying all over the place. As a matter of fact, I also remember reading in New York during the hot summer months how people were keeling over from drinking too much cold water because the cold water was supposedly having a shock. This is how a lack of science made us think that, oh, cold water is what was killing people, or, you know, this the sickly season was just besieging us, not knowing that these little critters like mosquitoes and so forth were carrying diseases. Anyway, and it's probably because these mosquitoes were basically festering and living in human waste and so forth. Anyway, all prisoners of war taken on either side on land or sea shall be restored as soon as practicable after the exchange of ratifications of this treaty. It is also agreed that if any Mexicans should now be held as captives by any savage tribe within the terms of the United States as about to be established by the following article, the government of the said United States will exact the release of such captives and cause them to be restored to their country. Article 5. The boundary line between the two republics shall commence in the Gulf of Mexico, 3 leagues from that land opposite of the mouth of the Rio Grande, otherwise called Rio Bravo del Norte, or opposite the mouth of its deepest branch, and if should have more than one branch emptying directly into the sea, from thence up the middle of that river, following the deepest channel, where it has more than one to the point from where it strikes the southern boundary of New Mexico, thence westwardly along the whole southern boundary of New Mexico, which runs north of the town called Paso. And so we ended up getting Paso in the purchase, but we'll pick it up on Article 5 on Friday. And so as we go through this, we'll kind of see how this treaty being done by a military man was, I think we got everything we would have wanted, and I would have been afraid of having a politician do this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.